I'm the medical director at Community Health Center, which means I oversee all the medical aspects of care of patients here, prescribe the medications, monitor their recovery from a medical standpoint, along with my counselors.
How long have you been here?
I started here in 2013.
2013, but you've been doing this a long time.
Right. I was actually trained at City Hospital. I was an OB-GYN, trained back in the early 80s, finished there in 83, actually. And at that time, of course, heroin's always been around, and it was a pretty significant problem at that time. And I was interested in recovery and also treatment, and I was fortunate to have one of my professors who was very versed in this train me. That's how I kind of got started. And I've done that throughout my career on a sort of a minor basis. I mean, it was focused on my OB-GYN practice, but did take care of addicts through that. And then starting in 2010, I developed a medical problem which precluded me from being able to operate. And so, therefore, I switched over to doing addiction medicine full-time.
Okay. I guess since you've been doing this a long time, how has, treating addiction changed? It's probably a pretty big question. It's changed a lot?
Right, it has. In the past, when we do methadone dosing here at Community Health Center. And because methadone is a very powerful drug, it has to be through very controlled clinics, such as what we have here. They're all federally regulated, and there's multiple ways that is the rules that we have to follow. But back, and those clinics were initially set up in 1959 in New York City, was when they first started out. And so the philosophy was originally harm reduction. What it meant was bring these patients in and protect society. In other words, dose the patient, keep them in relatively high doses of methadone, keep them from stealing, preventing hopefully sexual transmission of diseases by decreasing prostitution, those sorts of things, but really not worry so much about the recovery of the patient. It was to protect society. That philosophy has changed, and that's how our philosophy is here as well. Get the patients in, use the meds as necessary to help them to achieve sobriety, being clean, with the goal of treating the patient, concentrating on the individual for recovery, which then will get you the secondary gains of treating society.
Okay. Tell me what methadone is.
Okay, so methadone is a very potent opioid. Okay, it is a natural substance developed from the poppy, just like heroin is, or any of the Oxycontins, those kinds of drugs. Okay, let me correct myself. They're actually the other opioids, codeine, those kinds of things. Oxy is a partial synthetic product. It was originally developed for pain control, but the problem with methadone is it has an extremely long half-life, which means it sticks around a long time in the body. Most opioids, let's say Oxycontin, for example, has a half-life, which means how long it's effective, really, of about maybe 6 hours. So that's why patients and heroin's the same way. So those addicts have to go and dose multiple times in a day. They're shooting up every 6 hours, so multiple times. The problem with that is they develop tolerance. So in other words, the dose has to keep going up, going up, going up, okay? Now, methadone's unique in that its half-life is about 24 to 36 hours, meaning that you only have to dose once a day. And because of that, you do not develop tolerance. Also because of that, you really don't get a high off methadone. By the pace times the patients reach us, that part of their brain has changed. Now, they'll seek the high. They're looking for it because it's so powerful in addiction. But they really can't achieve it because the brain's altered itself. But what happens is they become physically dependent, dope sick, okay? And so if they don't use, the major reason our patients come in and they're using, they don't want to be sick. They can't be functional. And so they come here. So the idea in using methadone nowadays is to get them on an equivalent dose or an amount of methadone to keep them from having withdrawal, so they're not having dope sick. They're not getting high, but they're not getting high anyway. Those days are gone for them. Due to this changes in the brain. And by doing that, now we can allow them to sit down and start working with our counselors, getting the 12-step programs. Because if you have somebody that's in withdrawal, think of having the flu, okay? Ever had a bad flu? Make it 10 times worse, and that's withdrawal. And if you had that and you were supposed to sit in a classroom and listen to a counselor, would you be able to? Of course not. So the methadone keeps them from being dope sick. That's really what it does. And it's not a substitution of one drug for another, which is often the confusion. Oh, we'll just give them one high for another high. Well, that's not how it works.
And it's different than Suboxone.
Correct. Now, those drugs work a little differently, okay? So the difference is this. Methadone is what we call a straight agonist. Agonist, think of as add-on, okay? So in other words, you can keep using, you can use methadone, you can put heroin on top of that, you can do all these other drugs, which is one of the reasons you have to be so careful and why it's so tightly controlled, okay? Because people can overdose and die very readily with methadone and using other drugs. It's a dangerous drug if you're not careful and know how to use it, okay? Now, let's look at, instead of, Suboxone's a brand name, so I would recommend that we use buprenorphine. That's the medicine, because there's different types of buprenorphine out there, and my analogy is, look, buprenorphine is like saying car, and Suboxone saying Chevy, okay? So let's be a little more generic and use the term buprenorphine, okay? So buprenorphine's different. Buprenorphine came on the market in 2002 as approval for use in addiction treatment. Now, it's a unique drug because it's both an agonist, like methadone, but it also has an antagonistic activity, that's anti, okay? Which means that when you use it, it has a ceiling. In other words, after approximately 16 milligrams, it doesn't do any good. You've essentially blocked all the receptors with the buprenorphine. So if the patient tries to overdose or just say they want to go out and just take the whole prescription you might give them, nothing happens, other than they get very nauseated. But they're not going to overdose because it has a cap on itself, okay? Unlike methadone, which is why we have to be so careful in giving people time to take it home, if they were to take home and took the whole amount we gave them, they very well may overdose and die. But with buprenorphine, that doesn't happen. It actually provides a protective effect, okay? And so that's why that drug, we use it a lot when we can. But there are various reasons why one drug may work better than the other in different individuals.
And what is that?
Well, a lot of patients with buprenorphine, a lot of it's psychological. They don't get any of the feeling that they're used to, okay? And they know it. They can tell. It also, the problem with buprenorphine, because it's both an agonist and an antagonist, okay, is that if you give it to somebody that's got opiates on board, so say somebody used some heroin, okay, and they may be in early withdrawal, but they're not in full withdrawal. So it means they got some heroin on board. And you give them buprenorphine, it'll withdraw them. It knocks the opioids off the receptors and binds itself. It has higher affinity or higher sticking power. And therefore what happens is you put them into withdrawal. They get instantly dope sick. And so a lot of confusion on the street is that, oh, look what happens. That's going to withdraw you. So I want methadone because it won't withdraw me. Okay? So there's a lot of misconceptions out there. And a lot of patients say it's just not the same. It just doesn't work as well. And there probably is some true biological effect. There are probably some patients that actually, just the way the receptors, the nature of them. Because remember, all of us have the same receptors, but we're slightly genetically different. Okay, so some of us have blue eyes, right? Brown eyes, right? Our receptors are a little different. So one drug, although they go to the same place, probably fit better than the other.
Kind of like antidepressants, probably.
Exactly. Very good analogy. That's exactly right.
Okay, I have more questions about all that, but let's talk about Vivitrol. How does that fit in to what we're talking about?
Okay, so Vivitrol was originally produced and used for alcohol dependence. It helps to decrease the use of that. However, it doesn't work real well, okay? It helps, don't get me wrong. We do use it still. But it sort of didn't have a good home until we started doing the studies. So the company did the studies with use of their opiate treatment, okay? Now, the Vivitrol is a straight antagonist, okay? Remember we talked about, so we have heroin's an agonist or methadone's an agonist, okay? We have buprenorphine, which is between the two, and now we have Vivitrol, which is a straight antagonist or straight anti. And what that drug is actually now Traxone. Vivitrol is the brand name. It's the only type of drug that's available that does this. And it's an injectable drug. It's given every 28 days. And what it does is it binds to the receptors where opiates would go. It does not stimulate them. Okay, so you get nothing happens to you. It is not dependent. So using it does not, well, do I have to detox of it? No, you can stop at any time. There's no problem with doing that. But it binds the receptors and does two things. Number one is it decreases cravings. Okay, so the way you use this, you can't use this in someone who has opiates on board. Okay, if you did, you will put them in a severe withdrawal. They will get extremely sick. Now, they're not going to die, but they wish they could. Okay, so we have to have somebody that's in detox. They have to be off anywhere from 7 to 14 days, totally clean, and they got to be in a program. They can't just, you can't just rely. And none of these treatments are going to work by themselves. They all require counseling, 12-step programs, these kinds of things. All right. So we give them, we've got somebody that's clean. More, let me give you an example. Where I use this a lot is I have somebody who I've, say, I've had them on methadone or buprenorphine, okay? And we've treated them, and we've slowly, over time, gotten them into a program. They're demonstrating recovery. They're getting their life back. I like to say their back pain gets better. You know, the judge is on my back. My wife's on my back. The, you know, you get the idea? So the back pain is getting better. Life is getting better. They're getting into recovery. And we're slowly, slowly, slowly tapering their doses down, because the long-term goal with both buprenorphine and methadone is to get them off the meds and sustain their life with these other treatments. Because the drug addiction, and whether that's alcohol or opioids or whatever, the drug is but a symptom of the disease. The disease is lifestyle, it's behavioral, it's all these different things, genetics. And so the long-term goal is to get them off those, use the buprenorphine, use the Suboxone as a bridge. Help them get to the point where they've developed a different lifestyle behavior, okay? But a lot of my patients, what happens is life's gotten a lot better. Life is good, they're coming off their meds, but they're afraid. They're afraid of relapse, and they're afraid, I don't want to ever have this happen again, but I'm worried. And you try to reassure them about their programs, but still, they want something more. And so Vivitrol comes in a great place. I've detoxed them, they're totally off their opioids, and they want something more. So I put them on Vivitrol, and what it does is it blocks all the receptors. So if they would want to use, it doesn't work. There's no place for the opioids to go, for the heroin to go, okay? And so psychologically, if they're in recovery and they understand that, they're like, well, why will I say I will spend my $50 because I don't get anything for it, right? Okay? That helps them. Also, it does help with cravings. So, you know, part of the brain is I'm past the point where I'm physically dependent. I'm not in withdrawal. I'm not getting dope sick, if you will. But that little voice in my brain still is there, that little animal. Because remember, this is not a curable disease. Treatable, but not curable. There's always that little thing going on. Put them on the Vivitrol helps to cut that down. Okay, and how long do you use it for? It's different for every patient. And there's no time limit on this. It's not like, well, okay, well, 6 months, sorry, can't use it anymore. No, you can use it for basically as long as you want. But generally speaking, the longer they get their program going, and the more they're getting back into society, the more they're developing 12-step programs, those things, church support, again, a whole different way of living, there'll come a point where they're comfortable, and you stop it.
So there's got to be, what's the drawback to Vivitrol, for example?
Okay.
I mean, I know all of them probably have drawbacks, right?
Right, they do. Yeah, there's nothing perfect in life, right? Yeah. So if we talk about the bad things about Vivitrol, first of all, you have to make sure they're fully detoxed. And that can be tough sometimes, you know. In other words, you take somebody off the street, and they're using 2-3 grams of heroin a day, and you try to totally detox them. It's really difficult, number one. But let's say we achieve that. They actually have detoxed, but maybe not fully, and you give them this before they're detoxed, they're going to get extremely ill, you know, extreme withdrawal. So that scares people. So it's difficult to use it in that situation, okay? So that's one drawback. You have to be careful about causing extreme withdrawal. Number two is it has been associated with depression. Now, some of that's genetic, okay? And so if I'm going to use this, I'm going to talk to that patient. What's your history been? Have you had a history of depression? What's going on? Have you been treated? What's your family like? All right? And sometimes you have to be careful with doing that. Sometimes even with a negative history, it can develop. So you always have to be talking to these patients. You'll see them on a regular basis. What's going on? The incidence of that is actually quite low. But it is there, and we have to recognize it. Okay? So that might preclude some patients from using it. You have to be careful about giving this drug. Because of the way it's, the nature of the way it's made, it's in this microsphere molecules, you have to give it the injection site deep, and unfortunately it has to be given deep in the gluteus, deep in your butt, okay? Sorry. There have been reports of people tried to give it in the arm, that kind of thing. Because, you know, some folks, I don't want it there, I want it in my shoulder. It can cause significant tissue damage. So the company's real careful to teach people, but sometimes people don't want to listen, right? But anyway, so you can get a reaction to the injection site, as you can with anything. You know, get a shot of, you know, penicillin, right? The incidence is low, but it does occur. And so I'm thinking of the major type things. And of course, as with any med, you can have allergic reaction and those kinds of things, but those are all pretty rare and remote.
What about, and I don't know how much you know about this, but what about the cost? I mean, does insurance cover Vivitrol? Does it not?
Well, here's the deal. Vivitrol is about $1,000 a month, so it's expensive, no question about that. Now, the governor, about a year and a half ago, something like that, I believe, had passed a law that all Medicaid providers must cover it. So in the state of Ohio, if you're on Medicaid, you can get it. Now, some of the companies make us jump through some hoops to get there, but we've pretty much learned how to be able to do that. So if you're on Medicaid, you're probably in good shape as far as getting it. Private insurance companies, I honestly don't know. I can't, because there's so many. I don't know the story. They have deductibles or things.
The most you do here is methadone, right?
Correct.
About how many patients?
We have total in the clinic now approximately 700, somewhere 600 to 700. And that includes both here. I do the adult part of this, but we also have an adolescent clinic, which our other physician here, Dr. Becker, covers that. And I think we have, maybe 100, something like that. I'm not quite sure. I'm sorry. I'm asking one of my staff members here to help me out. So, but I think in the agency, 600 to 700 of patients are what we call are seen here. Okay, and those are just MAT patients or Medicaid addicted treatment patients. We have a lot of other patients that are in here for alcohol, cocaine, various other things. So the agency is, I can't tell you the total number of that. I'm talking strictly about the patients that are on medications.
What do you think about medication? That was called medicated?
Medication addiction treatment.
Addiction treatment.
Yeah, it's a treatment, yes. So I'm MAT.
I don't know if you can answer this, but does it work? I mean, what?
It does work. Okay.
You know, how successful are we here with this?
Well, that's interesting.
It's hard to say, right?
Well, first of all, we have to define what's success.
Exactly.
Okay.
Exactly.
So are you talking about patients that totally get off of the meds and are going to be not use drugs ever in their lives? I'll be honest with you, I don't know. I can't give you that because those are long-term studies. I mean, once they're treated and out of here and they're pretty much done with their counseling, we've lost them. So I can't really answer that question. But let's look at this study. There was some data, and this was from, I believe, 2013. It was just about the time I came here, that they looked at a comparison between MAT, and they defined success as 1 year clean, 1 year not using any other illicit substances, okay? And that was based here out of this clinic and versus another clinic which does not do medication-addicted treatment. And again, we're talking about opioid-dependent patients. And we have to be very specific, okay? We're talking about opioid-dependent patients. And our success rates were about 83%, all right? The other clinic was about 21%. I don't give you the exact figure, but it gives you an idea. So if we use that endpoint, it's highly successful. Now, long term, I can't answer you. Don't know.
Yeah, that's the point.
Yeah.
How many people are doing the Vivitrol?
We have probably about a dozen right now. It comes and goes. Now, the problem is you have to remember our clinic's a little unique in that we're having patients. We get, not to say this, let's see, I hate to say the worst of the worst, but the patients that are the sickest patients, okay? And so we require much more. I mean, that's why we use methadone here. That's why we use buprenorphine much more. What we're finding with Vivitrol is that we're starting to use it more for those types of patients we just talked about, the ones that are finishing and they still want something more. Now, a lot of our patients don't. A lot of our patients have developed a good program and they don't need it. But for those that want that extra security, excuse me. We also are using it for patients that they have an opioid problem, but say they get incarcerated. Okay, they're opioid dependent. They have the disease, all right, but they get incarcerated, and then while they detox in jail, It's a very bad experience, but they get through that. And maybe they're in for a couple, 3 months, I don't know. And then from there, oftentimes part of treatment or plea agreements or different things, they come to our inpatient facilities, Raymar, okay? But they get there, and now what's happening is, like we talked about earlier, they're not physically dependent, remember? They're not dope sick, per se, because they've got through that. But that brain, the cravings are going. Now, sometimes I will admit, we will put those patients on methadone or buprenorphine, but more and more I'm getting patients to get them to use Vivitrol. And remember, I can't make a patient do anything. I mean, I can't make them take drugs. You know, that's not going to happen. So you have to always deal with counseling and doing that. But we encourage them more and more to do that. And patients are finding out, hey, he's right. And now it does cut their cravings. It cuts them about 50%. Okay? So think of a scale of 1 to 10. 1 being no cravings. 10 being the worst cravings you can imagine. If I put them on methadone or buprenorphine, I take that down to a 1 or 2. Because remember, I'm giving them basically what they had been using, right? With Vivitrol, cuts it down to about a 4 to 5. So there's still some there. And a lot of patients just aren't satisfied with that. Remember, the disease of addiction is I want what I want when I want, and I want more of it than ever. That's addiction. That's just what it's all about. And so sometimes it doesn't. But for those that you can get them to try or are really interested in recovery, maybe they're afraid to go back on a narcotic-type drug, you know, such as buprenorphine or methadone, this is a great alternative.
So when they come here, this is an assessment that you do.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you figure out what's the right thing for it.
Exactly. My staff and I want to make sure it's not just me alone. This is what lots of counselors, lots of other people are helping me make those decisions.
So methadone, did you say it's an everyday?
Right.
So they come here every day?
Right. Methadone, remember, we talked about half-life, right?
Yeah.
24 to 36 hours. So they have to dose every day versus, say, heroin, where I got to take it every few hours, right?
Right.
So once a day dosing,
they come
in, and we have to find their dose. And because methadone has this long half-life, you have to be very careful in dosing it. It takes about 5 to 7 doses to reach a sustained blood level. In other words, you dose them, it goes up a little bit and stays, and goes up a little bit and stays, and then it kind of equilibrates. So as you're dosing these patients, you have to be careful how rapidly you take them up. But eventually, we work really hard, try to get them comfortable as soon as possible, because obviously I don't want them using, especially now with all the fentanyl and carfentanil that's out there. They're using that along with their methadone, and they die. Overdose, serious problem. And we work really hard to educate them. But if you got somebody who's starting on a methadone, and you have to start at 30 milligrams, that's federal guidelines, okay? We have lots of rules to follow. You know that that's not going to keep them from being totally without any withdrawal symptoms. And as much as we counsel them and ask them not to, they're not going to be sick. They're going to treat themselves. And so hopefully we can get them up to a dose rapidly enough that they don't need to use any further. And then they get in once a day dosing. Once their dose is established, they're set. And they don't develop tolerance because of that long half-life. So we have people that have been in this clinic, unfortunately, we're, 42 years old, I think this clinic's been established. And so there are people that have been here a long time, back when that older philosophy, remember we talked about harm reduction? And they've been on it so long that we're not going to be able to get them off. Their brain has been altered, their brain chemistry is altered. But they're doing great in society, they're functioning, they're doing well. But they're on that same dose for 20 years.
Really?
You know, this is a very complicated disease. Think of it like this. This is a chronic illness which is no different from any other chronic illness, diabetes, for example, or hypertension.
Right.
And it's interesting, if you look at the data, we look at recovery or compliance rates or success rates, recovery rates, in all three of those, believe it or not, addiction medicine does better, just slightly, but it does better than the other two. Okay, but the difference there is, let's use diabetes as our example. The difference in diabetes, it's a lifestyle change, right? These patients have to follow what they eat. They got to follow their exercise. They got to watch their weight. They've got to check their blood sugars on a regular basis. They got to take their insulin properly, right? And they have to do that every single day, okay? But it's medication, you know, their insulin, along with these other lifestyle changes. And let's face it, oh, that's a disease. You poor person, you have diabetes. The addict, on the other hand, needs to go to 12-step programs, church, whatever works in those steps. I'm a big 12-step recommender. I think it really works. The success has been there, of course, Akron, Ohio, we're the home of AA, right? So And they need to do that every day. They got to funnel those. Now, do you have to go to a meeting every day? Maybe not. Some do. Some don't. But they got to do something every day to fight this chronic little voice in their head that will talk to them. Okay? So it's not a medication necessarily. Now, again, yeah, do we use these meds to tide them over to get them there? Yeah. But the long-term goal is get them off their meds, have them work these lifestyle changes, right? Now, are there some people you're never going to get off their meds? Yeah, there's some interesting data coming out that says, with buprenorphine, for example, there's a study out there that's suggestive that, let's look at patients with a low thyroid, okay? Now, if you run, we call it subclinical hypothyroidism. So what happens is that their thyroid is working, but it's not quite where you want it to be. Or perhaps a better example would be patients that have this low-grade depression. Now, depression is controlled by a neurotransmitter called serotonin. And these patients just have a slightly low serotonin. So they're always kind of that ER patient, if you will, okay? And we found if we put them on antidepressants, which increases serotonin, okay, or in the thyroid patients, putting on very low doses of thyroid, boom, it brings them back up to where, quote, normal is, and they function quite well. So there's some interesting data that there may be patients with low dopamine levels, which is a neurotransmitter affected by opioids, and they're just on that low level. They function, but they're just not quite happy, or they have difficulty enjoying life. And give them a small dose of buprenorphine, 2 milligrams, really low dose, just brings them up and they're functional, and they do quite well. Okay, so what's the problem? If they need an antihypertensive, or they need diabetes, or they have need their insulin, we treat them, right? Why wouldn't we do it in this situation?
Interesting. Now, are you ever going to, do you ever get to a point where you have to turn people away?
Well, here's the thing.
Is there a max to the number of people you can
help? I'll tell you, yes, I'm sure there is. Okay, have we reached that point? Yes, and probably past it. But the situation is this. With the opioid epidemic that's here and how bad it is and how many people are dying, it's really tough to close your doors and say sorry. You know, how am I going to, you know, you want to be, you know, was it Solomon to make the decision? Because I'm not ready to do that. So we try to do the best we can. Probably our biggest limitation by far and away is counseling. Because that's the heart of the matter. It's the counselors. And there's such a demand, it's hard to find well-trained counselors. You know, if you want to make a good living and have a job, go back to school and become a counselor, okay? So that's probably our limiting factor. And also just our facility. You know, we only have so much square footage. We only have so many offices. And the counseling takes lots of time. And this is not, you know, a 10-minute visit.
So what's the answer? How are we going to tackle this?
Yeah. Well, the easy answer is money. I mean, of course. We have more money, I can pay more counselors, and I can get a bigger building, right? So it's like every other thing. Yes, money is unfortunately the ultimate answer. But I think the other thing is it's education. It's educating the public. Look, this is a disease, guys. So many of my patients, I had a lady today, as a matter of fact, she has some other medical problems, and she came in and I said, oh, well, you know, I just can't take care of my other medical problems. I'm too busy here. So, but certainly we've identified them. We say, look, we need to get you to family, you know, to your family practice doc or somebody, internist, whatever. And she said, well, the last one I went to, as soon as he found out I was on methadone, he threw me out the door because, you know, he's not taking care of, you know, and this lady's doing fine. She's in great recovery. She's not relapsing. And yet they're ostracized, you know. So it's educating. This is a disease. Same thing with the court systems. And I will say in Summit County, I think our court systems really do a good job. We've spent a lot of time educating them, working with them, and I think they're very progressive. And as to some other counties, which I will not name, okay? Don't put that in there. But anyway, but please let Summit, put something about Summit County, because the court systems here have really worked really hard with us, and they do a really good job of recognizing that it's a disease.
Do the court systems refer people here?
They do. They do a lot. Yeah, we have a number of different programs. Jan can probably
speak. Summit County probation department has an opiate unit. where everybody who is arrested for an opiate offense goes into that unit, and we have an excellent relationship with them, and we do a lot of work with them.
Okay, yeah, that's what I thought. That's great.
And the second thing is educating, getting to children, adolescents. You know, so many of our patients started their drug use in their adolescence. You start taking their history, and they'll tell you, you know, oh, yeah, I was, you know, 12, 14, I started smoking a little pot, I drink a little bit, and then this happened and that happened. And that doesn't mean that everybody that smokes pot or drinks in their teenage years becomes an addict. It doesn't work that way. Let's face it, you know, a lot of people have experimented with things in their adolescence or maybe in college. And they went on and did just fine. So it's more than that. It's their, you know, there's a strong genetic component and what's involved in their lives and all that sort of thing. But it's that young age group when they're very impressionable and those brains are still developing. And that's why we really got started on this adolescent program. We're really one of the few in the state.
Yeah, what is that?
So what we identified was this problem developing in, you know, this teenage years, if you will, okay? And what would happen was very frequently these adolescents would overdose. They get to the hospital. They're not quite sure what to do with them. They would treat them, get them through that overdose, and then what do we do with them, right? And I don't remember. It was probably about 2-3 years ago. I was in a meeting over at Akron Children's Hospital because they're asking, what do we do? What's going on? And they're saying the case was actually a 12-year-old child who was shooting heroin. Her parents had taught her. And she was in significant withdrawal. And they're asking me, what can you do to help us? And I went, I can't do anything because, you know, these meds are for adults and et cetera, et cetera. And one of the physicians looked me straight in the eye, the ER physician, says, so I can prescribe a drug to you that can addict to a child and that'll addict that, get that child into addiction, but you can't prescribe something to treat them? And he caught me. And I said, wait a minute. We got to rethink this. And so one of our counselors, who was very well trained in adolescent addiction treatment, and I got together and we set up our program. And we drew from other few other places around the country. And
wow. So is it an MAT?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, no. We have to be careful about that. So MAT treatments are much more controlled, like we talked about.
Yeah.
They have to be very guided. So what we did was we set it up more like a program. Well, buprenorphine. We only use buprenorphine. We never use methadone on adolescents, number one, because it's not approved. Okay. So we only use buprenorphine. Second thing is because buprenorphine is a little more liberal. And, yeah, are we using it outside of what the parameters of what the package insert is? And the answer is yes. But almost all drugs that are treated with children are that way. Because they're not doing studies, and they take adult studies and use them on children, and they know what they use. Of course, they dose appropriately for a size and all that sort of thing. So it's really not few drugs that are truly tested just for children. Okay, so we're not doing anything that isn't done for most other medications.
Wow, that's amazing, though. And then, isn't there something like a daytime detox? Or
we do. We bring the. What happens is we have a child who's been identified as needing detox, okay? And there's a whole lot of parameters. It's not just a kid who one-time experimented with some Oxycontin and got out of grandma's kitchen cabinet. These are kids that have either overdosed or have a chronic history of usage. And we'll bring them in, and remember I told you, you can't use buprenorphine directly. So we bring them in. We've got ways of detoxing them. There's other ancillary meds we can do to help them get through that. And then once we know they're opiate-free, based on drug testing as well as their, you know, clinical behavior, clinical review by us, then we'll start them on buprenorphine.
What do you think is going to be the future of addiction treatment?
Wow.
There's never going to be enough beds. There's never going to be enough.
Yeah, I agree. Well, I think that we have to look at this. Look, more people are dying of overdose than are dying in car wrecks. Okay, so let's go back. What did we do in the 50s and the 60s when we were all these people dying in car wrecks? What did we do? We developed seatbelts. We developed better cars. We looked at better engineering. We hit it better roads, right? All these different aspects, and that's what it's going to require for addiction. It's not going to be a silver bullet. It's going to require all these things, education, certainly. Helping the court systems understand, putting people in jail for low crime events, theft, whatever, just disciplining drug, does nothing. They get more education in the prisons. They'll tell you that. I mean, I treat care lots of these people have been in and out of court, been out of prisons, and they got smarter about how to use drugs and what to do. So it's working on that aspect. Yes, we need the police. Yes, we need to try to help decrease the amount of drugs that are coming into the country. But let's face it, we've had the war on drugs since the 60s, and has it done us any good? So it's a piece. I don't want to malign it. Yes, it's a necessary piece, but it's not where the emphasis needs to be. The emphasis needs to be on the education, on the treatments, on have better facilities, more counselors.
Yeah. Do you see using Vivitrol more?
Yes, absolutely. Yeah, we will definitely be using it more, trying to develop more of that program. We're working with the jail court systems now to refer more patients to us, like that's what we talked about earlier, and we're going to be start using it more for that reason. So, again, Vivitrol is not the silver bullet. It's another tool, that's all. And it's a good tool.
Okay. Interesting stuff. You see success stories here?
Yeah, absolutely. Yes, you do. You know, it's I make my analogy, it's sort of like playing golf. You know, you go out and you hit three or four really crappy shots and you're thinking, what am I doing? And then you hit that really good one, right? And that pumps you up to get going to hit the next couple bad ones. You have to understand this is a tough disease. And I can't just give them a med. I can't just push a button and make them better. It requires the patient to want to get better, okay? And how do you do that? I don't know. I mean, all we can do is just keep working at them and working at them. But when you get those really good ones, when you get the ones that do make it, and they come back and tell you, and they tell you, you saved my life, you changed my life, and you watch them as they progress through here, and I watch them, their doses go down, I watch what happens with them, or you help, we treat a lot of pregnant patients here. We work with SUMA, okay? And because of my background being an OB-GYN and addiction, kind of puts me in a unique position, and the physicians at SUMA are the OB clinic that we work with, and other physicians in the community that treat that are wonderful. And we have a great working relationship. And you watch a woman come in who's pregnant, has been living on the street, whatever, and you get into a program. And also, a lot of those patients we put in our inpatient facilities, either Touchstone or Raymar. And you watch this lady change. And these patients all love their babies. I've taken care of hundreds, okay? Probably in the thousands now, I'm getting old. But the point is that they're just like anybody else. They love their babies. They just have a tough disease. And you watch that disease get better, get treated, and you watch how they develop, and you watch families reunited. Very powerful, very rewarding.